Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on January 30th, 2011, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Please welcome Shelley Wanger.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much. And I also want to congratulate you on this great series. And every series you do at Film Forum, which we're also grateful for. I only met Fritz Lang once, and it was the late 60s, and the historian Arthur Schlesinger, who was reviewing films for Vogue, brought him by my mother's apartment on 72nd Street in New York. I was, I'm afraid, a typical teenager. I had not seen any of Lang's films, and as I sat on the couch with him and Arthur, I just thought he was a nice old director with a black eye patch who had worked with my mother. I had wanted my sister Stephanie to come, but she was sick today, so alas, she couldn't be here because she remembered going to visit Edward G. Robinson and seeing his art collection, which I thought would have been fun to hear about. My eldest sister, Diana, who is from my mother's first marriage, used to go on the sets for a lot of the Fritz Lang movies, but alas, she's in Los Angeles. As I looked at Woman in the Window again, I was struck by what a modernist and an aesthete Lang was. He was born at that amazing moment, 1890, the end of the Belle Epoque in Europe, and the very next few decades would be the beginning of modern movements in art and architecture. The secessionists in Vienna, the Bauhaus in Germany, and you remember his father was an architect, and apparently he'd wanted Lang to be one. And Lang had run away from home and gone to Paris, studied art, and his own work, Lang's own work, looked a lot like Egon Schiele's, who he absolutely worshipped and later would collect a bit of his art when he could afford it. If you see pictures of Lang's office and his apartment in Berlin, they have stunning sort of Bauhaus metropolis lines and fantastic metal and wood furniture. Lang's aesthetic perfectionism, however, obviously drove everyone crazy on sets. And during the filming of Scarlet Street, Edward G. Robinson, as reported in Patrick McGilligan's book on Lang, remembers him endlessly rearranging the folds on Kitty's negligee so she could cast a certain shadow he wanted. And Robinson also remembered another story about Scarlet Street where apparently Lang didn't like the way the light was shining on the floor, so he had it washed, and then he still didn't think it looked right, so he then put dust down and then he swept it himself. You'll see the set for Alice's apartment and Woman in the Window has a distinct whiff of modernism. Look at the fireplace, the couch, the coffee table, even the calla lilies in one scene and the birds of paradise in another, in the vase on the coffee table, scream, period. My parents would each be involved in separate projects with Lang once he came to Hollywood in 1934 from Paris. You remember he fled there from Berlin after Goebbels had offered him head of the German cinema for Hitler, and Selznick had gone to Paris and offered him a contract for MGM and brought him over to New York on the Ile de France. My father was born in 1894 in San Francisco and was only 4 years younger than Lang. In 1937, he produced Lang's second American film, You Only Live Once, with Sylvia Sidney and Henry Fonda. It was a property my father already had, and it was Sidney who suggested Lang, since she just worked with him on Fury. Lang got final cut, but still complained that the prologue he thought would have made the film a success was not allowed by my father. Lang's sixth film in America, Manhunt of 1941, his first anti-Nazi picture, starred my mother, Walter Pidgeon, John Carradine, and George Saunders. The next Lang film my mother did was the one you're going to see, Woman in the Window of 1944, which she made when she was 32. Produced by Nunnally Johnson with the former Fox executive Bill Getz and adapted from a popular 1942 novel, Once Off Guard, by J.W. Wallace. The following year, 1945, my parents, Lang, and screenwriter Dudley Nichols formed the semi-independent company Diana Productions, named after the daughter from my mother's first marriage. It would last for 3 years and two films, Scarlet Street of 1945, a success, and Secret Beyond the Door of 1948, not a success, before they all quarreled and disbanded the company. I'm going to read you a few paragraphs from a letter my father wrote his lawyer on April 23rd, 1948. It's emotional, written in the heat of the moment, detailing typical disputes, but I thought it had some interesting facts in it. Dear Abe, as you know, Fritz Lang did a picture for me when I was with United Artists. I found him an impossible, dishonest guy and didn't speak to him for 2 years. Many other people had the same experience. However, he had bad luck and finally ended up in a very reasonable rate at Fox, where he made a picture called Manhunt with Joan, a very excellent picture because the man undoubtedly has talent. After Manhunt, which was a great success for Joan, she then did Woman in the Window, which was also a great success. During this time, Joan became Fritz's confidant. He came to her with all his troubles, and she would go in and fight for him with Zanuck and Goetz. He wouldn't move without her. Out of all this came the idea that poor Fritz Lang was an abused soul, and if only had a company of his own where he could get a chance to express himself, it would make a new man of him and remove all his inhibitions. Joan, from her charitable point of view, thought it was the right thing, as did Martin Gang, his personal lawyer, who was also under his spell. Now, I'm going to keep skipping paragraphs, but they're just a few that are kind of interesting. The next picture, as you know, was Secret Beyond the Door, a novelette which I purchased and held for 6 months while he made up his mind whether he wanted to do it or not. For this picture, he gathered onto himself a staff which became a complete cell, and there was no handling him at all. He insisted on spending $1.6 million on the picture when the picture could have been done for a great deal less. He adopted the method of playing everybody against one another and claiming that he was misunderstood and that he was responsible for everything that was any good in Scarlet Street, which of course was only a remake of a picture already produced by Jean Renoir in France and had also been a successful play. The fact that Scarlet Street was making some money, was considered a hit, made him more impossible than ever. He was uncontrollable on Secret Beyond the Door. Treated Joan dreadfully, blamed things on her, lied, refused to take any criticism at all, and ended up with a long, dull picture very much over cost. Okay, I'm skipping paragraphs again. This is a very sketchy story of 2.5 years of misery, because the time he took and the problems he made are really fantastic and beyond human belief. The man is a Prussian to the fingertips when it comes to detail and worries about something that's been said in a column about him. He was awfully upset because I got publicity in connection with these pictures, although he wouldn't even write a letter without my dictating it for him. He wanted all the credit. It's just been a nightmare, and I'd like to resolve it by seeing Joan get her money out of the thing and not letting Lang get away with it. How this can be accomplished, I must throw at your feet. So that's sort of the essence of that letter, but it does kind of give you a whiff of what it was like. And I think these things still go on, where you've got disputes between producers and directors, but that's just very extreme. All right, back to Woman in the Window. When I looked at Woman in the Window with its controversial ending, I had not seen it in years. There was the Paul Clemens portrait that had hung in both our Los Angeles houses, in the second house in the dining room, where one was sort of trapped gazing at it over family meals without any idea of its provenance. My parents never talked about their careers in front of us, and I never knew kind of what they were doing. So, I mean, it was nice in a way, but on the other hand, how silly. I wanted to know what that portrait came from. Seeing this film again, I did not know what I was going to feel, but I was impressed. The smart, witty dialogue, the great, believable performances, the crisp editing, those many shots of people framed in doorways, that Langian obsession of man in relation to society, crime, and fate. As a fairly jaded New Yorker, I found myself whipped into a state of total tension by the Austrian master of irony, paranoia, and creepily sinister. You're in for a terrific treat, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.